Hello and welcome to a very special Brewin podcast in which we're delighted to bring you an exclusive interview with co-CEO of Standard Life Aberdeen, Keith Skeoch. Our conversation covers the merger, of course, the trends in asset management, but also Brexit and whether the financial services industry is in a good place to weather the threat of a no deal. And here's what Keith had to say on the matter.
I think if there was a no deal Brexit, I think the financial services industry might be in a slightly better place.
Okay, well, I'm sure you'll want to hear some more explanation behind that comment and all the other topics covered. So please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Okay, hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gatteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're delighted to tick off another big name for the Brewin podcast, none other than co-CEO of Standard Life Aberdeen, Keith Skeoch. Thank you very much, Keith, for sparing the time to speak to us.
Real pleasure.
I thought we'd, the format for this podcast, I thought we'd split into three. The first part we'll discuss the merger, of course. And then the second part, we'll look at industry trends, maybe throw in a Brexit hand grenade for you to deal with, and then round out with some specific sort of Standard Life Aberdeen conditions. So getting into the merger, but before that, I guess the first question we'd sort of throw at you is perhaps whether you could give us any insight into the strategic thinking behind the name, whether the outcome of the name was a result of an arm wrestle victory over Martin, or whether it was a victory in a game of pool, or any other insight you could give us?
No, it was blindingly obvious that the name of the company was Standard Life Aberdeen, and that's the name on the share price. The asset management brand is Aberdeen Standard Investments. We, like so much in this merger, We got there pretty quickly.
Okay, right. Well, you've dealt with that one very professionally. Yeah. Thanks very much. Okay, right. Let's get into the merger conversation. Can you remind us all actually of the motivations behind the merger, and then just give us an update on how it's all going? I know there's some recent news on that.
Yeah. So I think there were really three big motivations for doing the merger. First was that we saw the marketplace as being disrupted, and disrupted specifically by four big trends. What I rather pompously call the democratization of financial risk, this idea that people will have to take more responsibility for their financial future, and as they do that, the big institutional structural mandates, DB schemes, those collective insurance vehicles on insurance balance sheets were under structural pressure. So the market was going to go, I think, for the want of a better phrase, more retail-y, quicker than you think. So that was going to put pressure on margins, and it would also change the shape of client demand. Second issue was really disruption coming from the fact about whether we like it or not, and we're speaking pretty close to the 10th anniversary of Lehman's and the financial crisis. Actually, there's a real lack of trust in financial services, and you need to build a kind of brand that's going to be trusted. Third big trend is affecting lots of industries, not just ours. Increasing use of tech and digitalization, where I think it has a profound impact on our business, is used to be the case that customers, clients had to pay for access to get a hold of funds. Technology has brought some of those barriers down, so the costs are falling, the returns associated with pure distribution are coming down, putting much more of an emphasis, I think, on service and relationships. And I think technology is a big provider for that. Fourth big trend, is we continue to operate in a slow growth, low inflation, low interest rate environment where volatility is high in financial markets. That puts both downward pressure on fees. If you're operating in, for sake of argument, a 4% return world, you can't take 1% away necessarily over a long period of time from those annual returns. I think, like that first element, it changes the shape of client demands. My own view is that increased volatility that kind of remains in place means that it ain't just low-cost beta that provides a solution. I think we're moving into a world where outcome-orientated solutions are really important, including those that dampen volatility. If you want to be involved in outcome-orientated solutions and what we call new active, you need all the componentry. So one of the reasons for bringing the two organizations together was we had complementary componentry, Aberdeen, EM, standard life investments, more developed markets, credit, and emerging market debt. So as we pulled that componentry together, we have increased capability and capacity now with 1,000 investment professionals. And when you think about, the changing shape of client demands, the pressure on fees, actually scale was always an important part of this merger. So, we are creating, I think, not just the largest asset manager in the UK, second largest active independent asset manager in Europe, but what I hope will be a national champion that has the scale and the capability to invest in these new active solutions, and that's going to be a source of growth for the future. So we kind of recognised, to be honest, we needed to disrupt ourselves whilst the market was disrupting us. And everything I think Martin and I have seen in the last 18 months, which has been a pretty tough time for the industry, has reinforced the rationale for the merger.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask you about your product range in the face of sort of current and future economic conditions, but you've done such a good job answering that we may even drop that question. But if I was to sort of think a bit more, look at sort of empirical evidence of how large acquisitions and mergers sort of go, I don't know if you've sort of seen the specific studies. I'm sure you'd be well aware that the odds are sort of stacked against you in this this regard. I mean, I don't know whether you'd be well aware of that, but any sort of methods that you've employed to make sure you can overcome those sort of challenging backdrop.
Yeah, so I completely agree, and I would also say I think my view, and I think Martin's view, is difficult things are worth doing. Just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's not the right thing to do. So I think creating this merger and providing scale is absolutely the right thing to do. We also recognised it was going to be tough. So where are we a year on? We're exactly where we thought we would be, and I think we're making a lot of progress. So the first thing we did was bring the distribution teams together, and that was really completed kind of early in the new year. And we've seen the benefits of that in terms of our first half gross flows picking up. We've also been bringing the 1,000 investment professionals together, creating a narrative around our investment capabilities. We're generating a lot of work on culture. We're having internal conversations about all of this stuff. talking about our sense of purpose, which is to invest for a better future, talking to people about what their future values would be. In order to facilitate that, one of the things we've done pretty early on is brought people together. So whether it's up in Edinburgh, 6 St Andrew's Square, all the investment teams, all the risk professionals, together in the one area in 6 St Andrew's Square, or in London where we've brought people together in Bo Bell's house, or in Sydney, or in Singapore. I think we've brought about 3,000 people into a common location. Once they actually start to talk to each other, you know, they start to recognise they're human beings and they're clever people, and they get on. So that's been important. I think the other thing you do is you bring people physically together. Is, you know, we obviously operate in a regulated business, and there were times until we got bits of the technology right, we had some physical Chinese walls. Actually, by Easter, those Chinese walls between the investment teams came down. So that was, you know, a physical, but also, I think, a symbolic componentry. We also, you know, are talking about the future. We're investing in the brand. You saw a lot more of us, you know, associated with the Scottish Golf Open. We're a couple of weeks away from the Ryder Cup. There will be a lot more brand collateral coming out that puts the Aberdeen Standard Investments name in place. So I think a year on, we've made really good progress. We've achieved a lot, but, you know, let's not kid ourselves. You're absolutely right. This is a tough thing to do, and there's still stuff to get on with and get focused at.
And sort of on a related question, I'm sure you've been have read that the relatively recent tie-up between Henderson and Janus has ended up with what would appear to be an acrimonious sort of split between the sort of co-CEO management set up there. I'm sure that was a great shock to you, given how much comfort you take from that structure in your own business. Or perhaps do you see some sympathy or recognise some symptoms that why that might actually transpire?
One of the things I've kind of learnt to do is, and I think Martin's actually the same, not see around too many corners, and kind of focus on our issues rather than other people's issues. So, you know, what I can tell you is Martin and I are getting on like a house on fire. You know, we are co-CEOs, we have separate areas of responsibility, and we chose those areas of responsibility ourselves because it's what we like doing, and that's really very helpful. You know, 600 billion of assets under management, 2 class 1 transactions in a year, clients in 80 countries with 46 offices around the world. There is plenty for both of us to do and play to our respective strengths, and we are cracking on and doing that as co-CEOs and a team. And one of the things I've said to people recently is and Mom would say, one of the things that's good is we share a common sense of humour. So having a sense of humour in these times is really, really important. So I think, you know, what I'm focused on and Martin's focused on is getting this merger done, doing the right thing for our clients, the right thing for our people, and making a success of it. You know, for sure we can learn from other people's mistakes, but, you know, Martin and I chose to do this, and we're both very, very focused on making a success out of it.
Okay, well, that's certainly clear in that answer. If we could perhaps now switch to the savings industry and the trends we're seeing, in particularly in the pension space, it's pretty evident that there's quite a seismic shift away from sort of annuities, DB to DC. So therefore, not so good news for a life assurer, but great news for an asset manager. And on that basis, it's a pretty good news story for Standard Life, you might say.
Yeah, and I think there are two components. The two components to the asset management story. So one, for sure, I think is, you know, the product suite, the fact that it needs to be outcome orientated, it's solutions based, but it's also risk based. So whether it's MyFolio, which, you know, for us grows from strength to strength. We launched it 7-8 years ago. It's now got 15 billion of assets. You know, it has certain risk characteristics, and it is there to deliver a return year in, year out for IFAs and DFMs. So getting that componentry in the right place for sure is important, and making sure that you have all those funds. But also, I think it isn't just about pure asset management. It is about customer service and it's about delivery. So, you know, when you look at the merger, you know, we sold the mature books of life insurance through Slough, and we've retained the platforms. So Wrap, Elevate, Parmenion, R1825 advice business. So I think the chain, the nature of distribution is changing in that savings and investment landscape. You know, as is, you know, the delivery mechanism and the componentry behind it. And actually, that's why we describe ourselves as a world-class investment company rather than an asset manager.
Okay, and I mean, I just sort of wonder on this sort of DC to a DB to DC transfer. I mean, we're just sort of seeing in the news, well, relatively recently, that the fear was that consumers were being encouraged to move into things that weren't necessarily appropriate for them. And then you sort of read very recently that MPs are feeling that businesses are paying too much to consumers to get them out of their DB situation. And you don't necessarily have to refer to that specific topic, but I just sort of wonder about the regulatory climate, the frequent changes that we've seen in not too distant future about pensions, whether there's something sort of in the pipeline, you know, the regulatory issues that you're having to deal with.
Well, I mean, I think there, you know, in terms of what could be described as conduct issues, where there is a change from one savings vehicle, you know, DB to DC, or you know, from one fund, or you change the nature of the fund. For me, you know, part of restoring trust is to make sure there's effective regulatory bite, and as an industry, we must hold ourselves to the highest level of integrity, and we must do at all times, as far as possible, the right thing for consumers. Because I keep saying to people in our business, you know, it's not winning assets, it's keeping them that's really important. And the best way of keeping assets is keeping the end customer happy. So I would distinguish between conduct, where, you know, we really do have to hold a mirror up to ourselves, and then the broader issues which occasionally buffet the savings and investment landscape. So actually having a regulatory and a tax environment which is stable, that allows people to make effective choices, is incredibly important. And one of the messages, you know, we push out to anybody that will listen is that it isn't just about getting the savings rate up here, it's about making sure the trust is high enough so that savings is turned into investment that does, you know, delivers a return for savers, wealth builders, and people, and provides an income in retirement. But it's also means of fixing the UK productivity problem, that you allocate capital in the right place, and you need a stable landscape in that. You don't need a landscape that's constantly shifting and changing. So, you know, we have had a radical set of changes. We need to make sure that those things work through, and you know, wherever we're being asked, we're asking for stability. Well, I think it's important there, I come back to the point, industry needs to hold itself to account, and we may need to make sure our conduct is is of the highest order, because as soon as it isn't, as soon as it creates an issue, that's what triggers change.
Well, I would agree entirely on that. But talking of changing landscapes, the Brexit issue, the Brexit hand grenade, here it comes. I was just sort of wondering, clearly the political risk seems to be on the rise. It doesn't seem as though anyone, even the Brexiteers, are really would prefer to have a clean break, very few of them at least. They all want a deal, but the risks of a deal falling through are on the increase. And I wonder whether, you know, whether you have any messages for the government or cabinet or the risks that a no deal pose to Standard Life or the financial industry at large.
So, you know, for Standard Life Aberdeen and I think the asset management and savings industry in general, the truth of the matter is most of us have been preparing for some form, you know, have had contingency plans to deal with a cliff edge Brexit. So having a separate entity, you know, we have a separate entity that we've created in MiFID to deal for segregated funds, and we have a separate entity in Luxembourg to deal with the management oversight and risk associated with the CCAV. And I think you're talking about, you know, tens of jobs here. So it's not a big fix. The doesn't appear to be any pressure on delegated rights. So I think the industry is probably in a better place than most. I think if there was a no-deal Brexit, I think the financial services industry might be in a slightly better place, because we have a well-understood system of global financial regulator, so regulation, so the national regulators will actually talk to each other. I think the real issue with a chaotic Brexit is really twofold: the volatility it'll create in markets, the uncertainty it creates for the economy, and I think that, you know, that is visible as you can see today. But also, you know, for those industries that are not involved in financial services, where there isn't a means of dealing with the regulatory issues, there's going to be a lot of noise. And if that starts to impact on our people, it'll start to have an impact. One of the things I've learned in 40 years in the financial industry there, and I've been through a lot of crises in my time, is don't look around too many corners. So I think there's an awful lot of water to flow in under the bridge between now and the point at which Article 50 bites. So, you know, we will deal, and industry needs to deal with whatever's thrown at us. You know, and I suspect what's thrown at us is probably going to be a little bit different from what we're seeing and hearing today. It's going to be noisy and it's going to be volatile, and we'll just have to cope with it.
Okay, well, thanks for taking that question. I just want to round out with two more questions, one related to Standard Life and one Standard Life Aberdeen, and one related to investment. I guess the Standard Life Aberdeen question, purely hypothetical, but just to pose to you, I just sort of wonder what you think perhaps consumers would be missing if Standard Life Aberdeen was a business that wasn't an option to them as a savings mechanism.
I think in the future it'll be the creation of all of these innovative outcome orientated solutions, the new active. We've talked about low interest rates, low inflation, much more volatility. I think people will be looking to make sure they have good, effective solutions delivered to them at the right price that help, you know, deliver a return but dampen volatility. And actually, you know, we need to be involved in disrupting the landscape on that front. We've launched about 20 funds over the past year. Plans to launch about 20 more. It's important the UK has a big, effective scale player.
Okay, well, my final question then is sort of really posing to the your former role as CIO, you know, asking a bit of a crystal balling here. I mean, you've talked a bit about volatility being constrained and likely to rise, or has risen and likely to stay there. I guess our the consensus view is that we're, you know, late cycle. There's a bit more to get out of equities, but maybe a recession's not too far away in the US back end of 2019. I wonder whether you would be inclined to be de-risking in portfolios, whether, you know, you're leaning on your product development team to be producing products that aren't so geared into equity market strength. You know, how are you sort of seeing the next sort of 12, 18 months?
So there is nothing in terms of all the leading indicators that we see, monitor, that suggests a recession is around the corner. There's nothing on the visible horizon that would trigger, I think, a recession at the moment. Clearly, there might be some kind of exogenous shock that does that, but nothing in the system at the moment. I think we also need to remember that, you know, this cycle, although it's been long, it's been pretty slow, and it's been led by the United States, and actually quite a lot of the outperformance of the United States has been associated with the outperformance of earnings. Inflation remains incredibly low. I can't see any pressure coming through from inflation, so margins remain relatively high. I think the other thing that's really important is, let's not forget, 17 was a banner standout year for equities. You know, we saw the resurgence of coordinated economic growth, and that got into the price very quickly. After such a banner year for equity returns, it's not unusual for the market to pause for breath. It's not unusual to have a bit of volatility coming around. So I'm not suggesting that you know, we're going to see another 2017, but I think you could well see in 19, on the assumption that what we've got is a slower world environment, but not a recession, a slightly better year for risk assets.
Okay, Keith, well, that rounds out this conversation. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak to us. I know you're an extremely busy man, perhaps even busier than I am, but that may be marginal. But as I said, thanks again for all of your responses and being so candid.
And thank you for the opportunity, and it's a real pleasure to talk to you all. Thank you.
Okay, to listeners, let us know what you think of the podcast on whatever platform you receive the podcast through. But until next time, many thanks for listening.